Terrence McNally. Welcome to Free Forum, a world that just might work. I'll be speaking today with Margot Suska, a former reporter, now a professor of journalism, accountability, and democracy at American University, about her first book, Hedged, How Private Investment Funds Help Destroy American Newspapers and Undermine Democracy. On Free Forum, we explore the lives, the work, and the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at politics, economics, environment, science, health, media, culture, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. The show streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn.com. Podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, most major podcast sites, and at my site, TerrenceMcNally.net, TerrenceMcNally, all one word, TerrenceMcNally.net. In my invitation to Margot Suska to talk about her first book, and I'm going to read the title again, Hedged, How Private Investment Funds Help Destroy American Newspapers and Undermine Democracy. I let her know that her subtitle alone features three issues I care deeply about. I believe private equity embodies capitalism at its worst. I mourn the relentless weakening and loss of newspapers and journalism. And I fear the rise of minority rule and the endangered state of democracy. Last June, I did my first episode that dealt with private equity with Brian Ballew about his book, Plunder, Private Equity's Plan to Pillage America. And I'm going to repeat some of what I said at that time, introducing that conversation. I usually account for the failure of the United States to do what's needed to confront the crises we face, crises that have either grown out of the distortion of our economy and our politics or are unsolvable because of them, inequality, climate change, an unhealthy relationship with the rest of nature, pandemics and public health, social and racial division and tribalism, crippled government and endangered democracy, by pointing towards greed and minority rule. I looked into private equity, eager to learn whether it actually relies on minority rule. Is it dependent on Republicans? Well, no. It appears in this case, since both parties enable it, greed alone is sufficient. I've been vaguely aware of private equity for years, certainly of the leading companies, Blackstone, Carlyle, KKR, and so on. And I knew it had something to do with Sam Zell's purchase and destruction of the Tribune Company and the LA Times, my hometown newspaper, and of the slow rot of nursing homes, which became deadly during the pandemic. So what is private equity? It usually works like this. Private equity investors take a little of their own money, some investor money, and a whole lot of borrowed money to buy up companies. Then they try to make changes and sell those companies at a profit in a few years. Private equity wants to sell quickly, so the need to make money fast drives their decision making. They load the companies they purchase with debt and extract a lot of fees. And here's the big one, and this was news to me at the time. Private equity firms are legally shielded from liability for the consequences of their actions. Think about that last one. Corporations exist to shield individuals. Private equity exists to shield corporations. We've had short-term and small-picture thinking, focusing primarily on shareholder return over other stakeholders, from employees to communities, to the national and global consequences of actions. We've had that for years. Same with too much debt, and also with avoiding liability. These have long been three of the greatest contributors to an economy and a financial and resource allocation system that fails us. What jumps out to me about private equity is that it is designed to embody these three flaws. They are features, not bugs. Economist Branko Milanovic and Harvard Business School professor and author of Reimagining Capitalism in a World on Fire, Rebecca Henderson, separately declared in my conversations with them that capitalism is a workable system, but it fails when business writes its own rules. And private equity invests hugely in lobbying to create, preserve, and expand their advantages in the marketplace. Today's guest, Margot Suska, narrows the focus a bit, looking at the actions and consequences of private equity when it comes to newspapers and journalism, and in turn, democracy. The founders and anyone who cares about the health of democracy knows that it relies on an informed and engaged citizenry. And since the birth of this nation, an essential contributor to that project has been newspapers and local journalism. Suska writes, "The public has a right to know how police, elected boards, and governments function using citizens' tax dollars. Newspaper journalism throughout modern history was the system set up to foster that knowledge." Charles Lewis, longtime producer of 60 Minutes and founder of the Nonprofit Center for Public Integrity and the Investigative Reporting Workshop, said that a journalist's job is to investigate the bastards. And because of the hedge funds, there are fewer and fewer reporters left to do this. Suska also quotes David Simon, the Baltimore newspaper man turned television writer, creator of The Wire. In testimony before a U.S. Senate Commerce Committee hearing on the future of journalism, he said, "In short, my industry butchered itself, and we did so at the behest of Wall Street and the same unfettered free market logic that has proved so disastrous for so many American industries. And the original sin of American newspapering lies indeed in going to Wall Street in the first place." Suska's assessment of the newspaper business after a couple of decades of private equity investment: what we have is not a crisis of profit. What we have is a crisis of greed and growing inequality. Margot Suska is American University School of Communications inaugural assistant professor of journalism, accountability, and democracy. She's worked as a reporter in Connecticut, Massachusetts, and Florida, and since 2016 has served as an associate editor at the Investigative Reporting Workshop, an independent nonprofit newsroom on American's campus. She is a 2002 graduate of the Columbia School of Journalism, where she covered the September 11th attacks and their aftermath, and we'll be talking about her first book, Hedged: How Private Investment Funds Help Destroy American Newspapers and Undermine Democracy. Welcome, Margot Suska, to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. Welcome, Margot Suska, to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work.
Thanks for having me, Terrence.
Okay, and let me tell listeners, we're recording this conversation Monday, February 12th. Margot, I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we talk about. So can you tell us in your own words a bit about how you see your path to the life you lead, the work you do? And feel free to go way back. I know you've had some career shifts and so on. So, you know, how did we get to what we're up to today?
Sure. So I grew up in Connecticut, and I grew up in a union household. My father was a Teamster, and I think that that had a significant role in the work that I do today. I was a big believer in the rights and of the working class. And I think that, you know, while I didn't choose the path of a labor organizer, I chose journalism as a career. I went to college. I got a master's degree from the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism. But I believed in the power of journalism to tell the stories of people who had been marginalized by the powerful. So very similarly to what my father believed in, that, you know, the working class had rights and that they should be rewarded for their labor, rewarded for their work, and that the wealth shouldn't just stay in the hands of a few. I believed in the power of journalism to really right the wrongs, whether or not that was the government becoming too powerful, or whether or not that was industry becoming too powerful. The work of people like Ida Tarbell, going up against monopolies in, the early part of the 20th century. So, you know, what troubles me and what led me to this book really was looking at this overclass of wealth, this ultra wealthy class of owners, a very consolidated few group of ultra wealthy investors who now own or, control the strings, so to speak, of, more than half of the daily newspapers in the United States in some way. And that really troubles me because it worries me about the free flow of information and who's going to hold those in power to account in a range of issues, whether that's housing, healthcare, nursing homes, the environment, and basic public safety.
Right. And what that the move you made from being a reporter to going into academia, what prompted that?
Well, I always knew that I wanted to be a professor. I had a professor when I was an undergraduate at the University of Massachusetts, Madeline Blaze, who was a Pulitzer Prize winning journalist. And I always looked up to her, and I knew that I wanted to be a journalist, and I knew that someday I wanted to teach. So I think that my path to becoming a professor was a little bit different than the one I thought that I would take. Mm-hmm. So I was a working local journalist for several years after I graduated from the Columbia School of Journalism. But I ended up going to Florida State University to get a doctorate in mass communication. I was very lucky that a little more than 10 years ago, I secured a job at American University here in Washington, D.C., and was able to, teach in journalism. And now I research the journalism industry. Journalism has been a part of my life going back to really more than 30 years. As a 14-year-old, I started writing for the Hartford Current student section. And it's been in some way a part of my life, either in the background or, now front and center, really for more than three decades.
Yeah. And how do you feel that your time as a reporter and the methods and manner of being a newspaper reporter, often with deadlines, quick deadlines, but but how that influences what you now do at American, both in terms of your research and your teaching?
Yeah, absolutely. So as a researcher and as a scholar, I try to blend the methods of investigative reporting techniques with more scholarly academic work. So I am what's called a political economist of media. So I study media ownership in the vein of the work of other scholars like Victor Picard and Noam Chomsky. So I look at media power. But I use investigative reporting techniques that I've learned first at Columbia and along the way as a journalist. I use a lot of documents. I use the Freedom of Information Act. And what I think being a reporter helped me to do is, I've learned how to take, hundreds and thousands of pages of records and try to distill them into a narrative. The chapter I have on debt begins with an interview with a Tribune bondholder who really lost his shirt when Sam Zell's Tribune declared bankruptcy. And I found the two-page letter buried in a trove of bankruptcy court documents. And I found this person, through the way I would have found anybody I was trying to interview when I had been a reporter. And I was able to contact him. And I found him in Texas. And I talked to him. The majority of shares of newspaper companies, both the equity shares as well as the debt in a lot of these newspaper companies, is traded by large institutional investors. That's, these large private equity firms and now hedge firms. But there are still some retail investors that are, regular people who try to make some money in the market. Mm-hmm. And he was one of those people who said, wrote to this bankruptcy court judge and said, I'm a regular person who basically got screwed over by the system. And I thought his story was important to tell too. So being a journalist really helps me, to do this kind of work, to use records, to use documents, to interview regular people, to try to put a face, on a story like this. And, I ended up doing 124 interviews for the book, mm-hmm. in addition to reviewing, if I had to count it, I'd say between 20 and 25,000 pages of documents.
Wow. I do want to ask you, Margo, about a couple of other activities that you're involved with before we jump more deeply into the book. And one is the International Fact Check Network. What it is and how you're involved with that.
So the International Fact Check Network is a project affiliated with Pointer, which is a nonprofit in St. Petersburg, Florida. And they have really committed the International Fact Check Network to, since, I've been involved with them since 2016, to trying, you know, trying to curb the spread of misinformation and disinformation, you know, that's out in the online and social media, you know, ecosystem. And so I work as a, you know, as a scholar, I have certain credentials that, you know, I understand sourcing and methodology, and I work kind of on a contract basis to try when a site like PolitiFact or the Associated Press Fact Check tries to become what's called a verified signatory, I review through a criterion that's been created by the International Fact Check Network. I review its, you know, its criteria, and I review a sampling of its fact checks, you know, to see whether or not, you know, they're maintaining the, you know, the criteria that's been created by this nonprofit. And the International Fact Check Network works with sites all over the world, understanding that problems of misinformation don't just exist in the United States.
Yeah. Right. So in other words, you're not out there checking the facts. You're checking the folks who want to be considered legitimate and credible fact checkers as to whether they really meet that standard.
That's correct. So I look more at methodology and sourcing. I'm not a fact checker, and nor would I want to be, but I think that there's, you know, it really is a kind of a very specialized kind of investigative reporting, really, when you look at some of the work that groups like factcheck.org do, affiliated with the University of Pennsylvania's Annenberg public policy work. I mean, it's really very specialized kind of reporting and a very necessary kind of reporting when you look at the way that, you know, bad information just goes viral on social media, not to mention the way that certain bad actors try to use that information, you know, to their advantage, really. And look at the way, you know, COVID-19 misinformation has spread, and, you know, not to mention political misinformation as well as disinformation, people who are actively trying, you know, to spread that harmful information.
Right. Let me just point out the distinction you just made in what you were saying was misinformation is information that is wrong. It may or may not be intentional. Disinformation is intentional use of misinformation. You also, since 2016, you've served, as I said in the intro, as an associate editor at the Investigative Reporting Workshop. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So the Investigative Reporting Workshop is a nonprofit, independent newsroom at American University, founded by Charles Lewis, who is a pioneer of the nonprofit newsroom space, a producer at 60 Minutes, who left when he didn't believe that they were doing enough independent investigative journalism decades ago, to found the Center for Public Integrity here in Washington, D.C. And a little more than a decade ago, Chuck founded the Investigative Reporting Workshop, where I've been lucky enough to be an associate editor. I help mentor journalists, young journalists, often upper-level college students and graduate students, in investigative reporting techniques. And we've had partnerships over the years with the Washington Post, the Chronicle of Higher Education. I think partnerships are part of the future of journalism. And I think that we've really done a great job with that. We've worked with Frontline in the past, you know, to try to tell better investigative stories. And our students work on projects over the course of months, and sometimes projects that can stretch out over years. And it's a really, you know, exciting time for nonprofit journalism. And I think we're really lucky to have that newsroom, which is now run by Pulitzer Prize winner Wesley Lowery.
Wow. And let me just say that I have interviewed Charles Lewis. I was thinking as you brought him up that I interviewed him, and we referred to his book, 935 Lies.
Yeah.
935 Lies was about the lies that got us into the war in Iraq. By the time I interviewed him, which was after Trump had become president, 935 seemed small in comparison.
At that
point, I think the Washington Post had Trump up to, you know, 3,000 or 4,000.
Wow. When I talk about him being a pioneer, and if you meet Chuck Lewis, you know, for anybody who's lucky enough to talk to him and to meet him, I think my daughter met him for the first time when she was 8 or 9 years old and decided almost immediately that she wanted to become an investigative journalist. And she had lived in a house with two journalists for years, but it wasn't until she met Chuck Lewis that she decided that was going to be the career that she had chosen.
Ah, that's a beautiful story. So this book, you sort of mentioned, you know, what drove you to it, but was, I ask authors often, was there a moment that you went, I've got to write this? What was that first itch that you went, this is now irresistible?
I actually was doing an interview not long after the Federal Communications Commission had relaxed ownership rules, basically making it easier for one company to own a newspaper and a television station or a broadcast outlet in the same city. So it was late in 2017, and I was doing an interview with NBC News Think. And the producer asked me, you know, and I was talking about ownership and consolidation of ownership as an academic, as a scholar. I'd read about them through the work of Robert McChesney. You know, these are, you know, some, you know, for years I'd studied them, and was talking about layoffs and consolidation and some of these issues. And she asked me, well, you know, well, how do you really know that it's really as bad for communities as you say? So when I really started researching the book, I started researching the newspaper chains. So I started researching Gannett, I started researching Media News Group, I started researching McClatchy, looking at layoffs and looking at staffing. And it occurred to me, you know, that the real story, as I started looking at these newspaper companies, wasn't the newspaper chains, but it was really the institutional investors that they are in debt to. And eventually, you know, it became clear that the hedge funds that had become the owners, well, Alden Global Capital, which by that time owned Media News Group, and during the writing of the book bought Tribune, and during the writing of the book Chatham Asset Management bought McClatchy, you know, that really these private equity firms and the hedge funds were the real story. I mean, they were the real nemesis of the newspaper industry dating back years. And so that became really the, you know, the research for the book. I wish I could say that I sat down on day one and I said, you know, I'm going to look at the private equity and the hedge fund influence. But, you know, this research really evolved over, you know, the course of several months, where it really took its, you know, took several turns and several twists. And it took a little bit of time before I realized that the real story here, in my view, was private equity and hedge funds, but it took a little while for me to get there realize
what was
that.
What was the story you thought you were looking at when you discovered that and realized that was the focus?
Well, yeah, I thought I was looking at a story about corporate newspaper management, maybe about bad boards of directors.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but and I think, listen, I think those exist, you know, I mean, really, you know, that's part
right,
of the
right.
story.
Yeah,
absolutely. But really what you see is that both of those and other factors as well were influenced by private equity first. The hedge funds own privately the chains. So, you know, the bad newspaper management is there. But really, I think bad newspaper management decisions were done in deference to private equity investors. Exactly.
What you found as you were looking at management was upstream of that, things that were driving them toward bad management.
Exactly. That's exactly right. So what you saw is, you know, in the early to mid 2000s, you know, what was happening is, as a result of private equity pressure to try to maintain revenues that had been stratospheric in the 1990s, you know, as the internet bubble was bursting and, you know, as, you know, eBay and Monster.com were coming on the scene, and these private equity investors wanted to still return these massive investments, they were putting pressure on newspaper management to try to return these once stratospheric revenues.
You're talking about these stratospheric revenues. I bet this piece is news to most listeners. We've heard now for whatever it is, 10 or 15 years, that journalism is in trouble, newspapers are closing down, staffs are getting laid off. So we may think that's how it's always been. No, these were cash cows at one point.
I mean, they were making 20 to 30% returns. I mean, that is That's a huge, I mean, there are very few industries in the United States that were making as much as newspapers in the late 1990s. But even now, I think your point is well taken that even now, newspapers tend to beat S&P 500 averages. The numbers are down, but you still have, when you collectively combine circulation and ad revenue, newspapers as a sector make some $20 billion a year. And that's a pretty, that's still a pretty hefty sum. And when you're a hedge fund and you've only got a few people in your head, in your firm, you don't have to worry about returning any money to any shareholders. That's a lot of money to spread around.
Right. So even this distressed industry that we see is distressed relative to what it used to be. But like,
Correct.
I think I know. I mean, I'm just going to say off the top of my head when you were saying 25% profit. I think the margin in most retail, except for luxury retail, is something like 4 or 5%. And here they were making 25, and now what you're saying is that the investors who purchase these cash cows now want them to still deliver something like that when circumstances have changed. And if they, I think that one of the big points you make is if they were satisfied with 15% or 12%, which is fine, we'd be looking at the industry completely differently.
Yeah, we're talking about a period, I want to be clear, in the mid 2000s, right? So what was chosen as a strategy was mergers and acquisitions. Let's forget about the internet. Tribune bankruptcy documents, which I reviewed, however many thousands of pages of them. Tribune's, bought by Sam Zell, this private equity billionaire. They say anybody that says we want to move forward with digital, basically fire them. We want them out of the company. Print is where our bread and butter is. I mean, it's almost ridiculous. So what you see are these legendary mergers, McClatchy and Knight Ridder, billion-dollar merger. You see Gatehouse, which is basically owned by a New York City private investment firm, Fortress Investment Group, buying up as many across the country as it can. So bigger was chosen, not innovation. So mergers and acquisitions was the strategy. And then what you have is the 2008 Great Recession, advertising losses, and then this debt comes, right? So then you have this catastrophe, right? So what I try to do in the book is to say, listen, the loss of advertising revenue is of course important to the newspaper industry, but we have to examine the 5 years before that
That's
to
right.
understand the conditions. Because if we don't understand those conditions, solutions will always be off base. We're never going to be able to fix the industry if we don't understand what the real history was that was happening between 2003 and 2008. And so, in my view, that history has not been documented. And that's what I wanted to do with
Yeah,
this.
then my guess is you looked around and you said, "Why isn't anybody else talking about this? Why isn't that book already written?" That kind of thing, right?
Yeah, absolutely. That's why I, interviewed 3 dozen, former journalists, some of whom were around at that time, who said, I was trying to, wave the flag to say, like, we need to do this. We've got, reporters had, from, small newspapers in these chains to, larger newspapers that, your listeners will know the name. St. Louis Post-Dispatch, which was, again, a cash cow for the Lee Enterprises chain, saying we've got to be able to invest in digital, and they were basically ignored. So to me, that was an important part of the history. And then what you had was these newspapers in debt, and then you had bankruptcies at several of the chains. And that's when hedge funds smelled blood in the water and they became owners, or they started buying up the debt. They became members of boards of directors, and they got say over the future of these over newspapers. So today what we have basically is an even more consolidated market. And of the top 10 largest newspaper owners, half of them are in some way either owned or in debt to these private investment firms, either hedge funds or private equity. I don't think we want the ultra wealthy. These are the Black Rocks and the Fortress Investment Groups and
Alden.
the Alden, that's right. I don't want them in control of the decision making of the most important democratic institutions that we have in the United States. And yet, that's where we are today as a sector. And essentially, in the other point that I try to make in the book is that we have a government system that has essentially failed, that has allowed the guardrails to come off. And, you know, the FCC has, you know, eliminated these ownership restrictions. We have an antitrust system that could have stopped these mergers along the way. It's failed. Department of Labor that has known about Alden Global Capital's use of its own employee pension funds to, you know, line some of its, you know, offshore accounts as going back to 2016, it's done nothing. And Alden has become, you know, a larger owner in the market. So, you know, I think that is also troubling to me is, you know, where is the government accountability piece as these firms have just been able to grow and grow?
Right. And as I mentioned in the intro, the founders knew that a free and robust press was essential to an informed citizenry. An informed citizenry was essential to a healthy democracy. And what you, I mean, if there was a single point about your book, it is that the need and purpose of journalism does not fit with the need and purpose of private equity and hedge funds, which is, as I said again in the intro, it's pile on debt, make short-term decisions, turn companies over. It's as I say, capitalism unleashed, and with, I mean, all it looks at is the bottom line. And that just is a very bad fit. And what you're also saying is, if the government has been turning the other way while this has been going on, where do we turn to save this? Because democracy is in peril.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's it. It is essentially, you know, a private capitalist industry unchecked. And I think it's just getting worse, you know, so who is watching the watchers? And, you know, I think that there is a glimmer of hope that, you know, we have had to reach the absolute bottom for people to pay attention. You know, I think, you know, the fact that you and I are talking about this, and I think this is a great, you know, there are other people, you know, Stephen Waldman, who's the founder of Report for America and Rebuild Local News, you know. He's now, you know, also, you know, getting a lot of attention for his work. The fact that, you know, major philanthropies in the United States have come together, you know, and they've said that they want to pledge $500 million to, you know, rebuild local news, you know, across the country. So, you know, there are some questions, I think, about, you know, is that going to be to existing sites? Is that going to be to large, you know, nonprofit groups or small nonprofit groups? So it's bringing attention, which I think is a very positive thing. The Press Forward initiative that Knight Foundation, you know, announced at the end of the calendar year last year. So the fact that we're talking about this, I think, is a real benefit. There have been a number of legislative initiatives. I was in Connecticut in July, talking to a state lawmaker there who was trying to get a bill passed.
Right. There are certain things where you have to publicly publish certain kinds of announcements
notices.
And things.
That's right.
And what they're saying
public
is,
notices.
Can we shift those to the papers that are local that really need it? And it provides at least a stream of income.
Public notices.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there have been, you know, movements to fund in California, you know, a core of student journalists to cover places where there are, you know, are no longer really robust functioning daily newspapers. And I think that's great, you know, but consider this, that 10% of state legislatures now are covered, 10% of the state house press corps are covered by college journalists.
Wow.
And, you know, I work with some very talented college students, but you know, you're losing decades, if not hundreds of years of experience with these layoffs. We've had 500 layoffs just in January For, you know, just in January of this year, more than 3,000 layoffs, 2023, you know, across newsrooms. And, you know, over the course of 15 years, the number of journalists in newspapers has dropped from, you know, from 70,000 to just above 30,000. So that is that loss of expertise in local and state and regional newsrooms is just going to be felt with an absolute thud. And so these are real concerns. So I think there are some hopeful, hopeful moments happening, but I don't want to overstate that hopefulness and, you know, by any means, because I think that that loss of expertise and what is filling it, you know, is really catastrophic.
Yeah.
It really is.
Let me tell people, this is Free Forum, a world that just might work. I'm Terrence McNally speaking with Margot Saska, a former reporter, now a professor of journalism, accountability, and democracy at American University. And we're talking about her first book, Hedged, How Private Investment Funds Help Destroy American Newspapers and Undermine Democracy. And one thing I'm going to take a couple of moments to do right now, Margot, is just flesh out a little bit more for people the whole private equity, what the meaning of that and what that looks like. Because I did that in that previous program that I did with Brendan Ballou. But to me, a lot of this information was new, and my guess is to a lot of listeners. So Americans for Financial Reform says that in recent years, the total gross assets of private funds, predominantly private equity firms and hedge funds, has grown to $18 trillion and is now almost as large as the overall $23 trillion in the entire U.S. banking system. And the way a private equity firm tends to work is it uses a little bit of its own money, a little bit of investors' money, and a whole lot of borrowed money to buy companies. An example is that in 2007, when Sam Zell purchased the Tribune Company, he saddled the business with $13 billion in debt that it dealt with by laying off 5% of its newsroom. Then a private equity firm tries to impose operational or financial changes because their ambition is not long-term. It's always short-term. It's to buy, refigure, and then sell. So it leads you to favor short-term over long-term in every case. And then they've loaded them up with debt, which now changes all the calculus of what's valuable and what's worthwhile keeping on and so on. And the craziest thing is that private equity firms tend not to be held legally responsible for the actions of their, quote, portfolio companies. And so you're on a very short timeline with very risky leverage, and you're not necessarily going to be held responsible if things go bad. And that last one is, to me, the one that really shocked me, which is that they have courts have agreed with private equity assertions that they do not own the companies that they invest in. They are merely advising investors, and yet they have the power, as you you knew, but I'm sure was reaffirmed in your research. They make the decisions. They have the power. The Center for Public Democracy says that private equity firms are responsible for about 600,000 layoffs in the retail sector in the past decade, at a point when retail was actually growing. And companies bought by private equity firms are far more likely to go bankrupt than companies that aren't. And we're talking about newsrooms, an essential piece of democracy. But the other things that they have gotten into in a big way are like nursing homes, which is one reason that things were so terrible during the pandemic. Research has asserted 20,000 premature deaths over a 12-year period from the National Bureau of Economic Research at private equity-owned nursing homes. Okay, so let me ask you two questions. How do private equity firms succeed when the companies they buy so often fail?
Well, that's a great question. So private equity often operates on what's called a 2-in-20 structure. So they are able to take essentially what's called a 2% management fee, and then they take 20% off the top of whatever is, whatever that revenue or that they're taking it right away. So that 2 and 20 fee can be very lucrative. So that and we saw that in the news industry when after the 2019 merger between Gatehouse and Gannett. Gatehouse for about 15 years was owned by the New York City private equity firm Fortress Investment Group. So after that merger, Fortress remains in the background of that deal. It's so fascinating because in the paperwork, when you look through the Securities and Exchange Commission documents, you see Fortress taking a one-time payout in 2020 of $30.4 million. So everybody, Gannett is laying off staff, and here Fortress is taking this fee from a company that, everybody's describing, as this business that's, dying and drowning. And you also had in 2022 massive layoffs at Gannett. The year before, their CEO, who was a longtime Gatehouse executive, earned a $7.7 million compensation package. That's the Gannett board of directors saying, like, great job for doing what? I mean, I can't tell, what
Yeah.
the heck he could have possibly done.
Right.
So
You
those are the
usually
kinds, yeah.
those big payouts we imagine are tied to some sort of performance.
Exactly. And what you, I mean, and basically, I think what it was these layoffs, ended up, you get rid of fat in the budget. And unfortunately, those are the people. Those reporters and editors and photographers who are doing the work of local democracy at the newspapers, at the more than 400 papers in this now mega chain. And those were the layoffs. So that's the way that these firms are able, this 2 and 20 fee, which is a very important part of a private equity, strategy. And you saw it in these, in the Fortress, kind of payouts that were documented in these US Securities and Exchange Commission records. And the Fortress is no longer getting that fee as long as I can tell from the last time that I looked at the records. But imagine a company that says, we're oh, sorry, things are so terrible, but they're giving $30 million to a New York City private equity firm that manages tens and tens of millions of dollars in assets under management, owned by a principal and co-founder, Wes Edens, who is a co-founder, a co-owner of a basketball team.
Right.
I mean, this is, you know what I'm saying? I mean, this is when I talk about wealth, I'm talking about extreme
Extreme
wealth.
wealth, which is actually
Yeah.
who usually owns sports teams and then
Yes.
get cities to give them great breaks to be located there that they'll never get back. LA has been tough with them on that. But one other trick they play, and this also just was shocking to me. And this is from your work in 2020. Chatham Asset Management brought McClatchy, which had fallen into bankruptcy, the Pension Benefit Guaranty Corporation, the federal agency that takes over pension plans from distressed companies, assume McClatchy's plan, freeing Chatham from those obligations. I know that is not an isolated case. What's going on there?
So that's another thing that I talk about when I talk about the flaws of bankruptcy laws in this country. And I wish now going back that I had talked more about this in the book's conclusion is that when these companies are able to get to use the debt financing, not to get too complicated here, but when they are able, rather than buying a company through equity, through shares, which has up to a 37% tax rate, companies that are able to get a company through bonds or through the debt, they are acquiring through paying 0%, paying nothing. And in many cases, if they're able to extinguish the debt through Chapter 11 reorganization, they're able to extinguish their debt, and then they have a new company, a new holding company, and they get a new, essentially, like it's like that Etch-a-Sketch game. If you ever played it as a kid, you just turn the dial, you get to eliminate all of that debt, or somebody else is assuming the debt. And now you just have a new, Fortress did this with Gatehouse. They essentially wiped away all of their debt and then almost immediately started buying up more newspapers and then laying off more reporters. So it just is a mind-boggling, flaw of bankruptcy policy. So one of the things that I did in the book was look at, who was on the Senate Finance Committee that was, involved in all these bankruptcy hearings, and looking at the money that some of these firms were paying. And it's no shock, that there's a direct line between some of these private firms and banking companies and U.S. senators who sit on this powerful, powerful committee. So, we can maybe go back to Citizens United as another nail in the coffin here,
Right. And one of the other things we talked about, that they pay themselves well. One other thing that private equity invests in is lobbying. Since 1990, private equity and investment firms have given over $900 million to federal candidates, and they love hiring them. Newt Gingrich, Paul Ryan, those are two speakers of the House, both hired by these firms to lobby for them, and all sorts of other big-name generals, CIA directors, vice presidents, senators end up working as lobbyists because that's where for them the rubber hits the road. It's not in how good is the journalism. It's in how good a system can we create for ourselves. They are better at business than they are at running nursing homes or newspapers or jails or emergency rooms, all of which, one of the things that in my looking at private equity, it was like finding places where the public really doesn't understand how things work. That's where government pays into it, like with jails and emergency rooms and so on. And those are very attractive targets to private equity.
Yeah. And Dan Quayle, former vice president, is the chairman of Cerberus. You find them behind the scenes of a lot of, some of these, the private equity financing behind some of these newspaper deals. And they're also heavily involved in the Irish debt markets. And I saw somebody quoted saying, you don't name yourself after the three-headed dog that guards Hades.
Yes.
If you want to be regarded as the nice guys of industry. To your point about private equity and lobbying, I think the point that I would make is that when these firms consider the bottom line as the most important, the thing to consider about these, this huge amount that they spend on lobbying is that it must be working, or else they wouldn't be spending it, because that is money that would be, going into the pockets of these, Wall Street, fat cats. That must be a nexus point between government and these Wall Street firms, which means that is another point of power between firms and government.
Okay, let me ask you one more question about something that isn't necessarily linked to private equity, and then I just want you to one more time before we close your reasons for hope and solutions you see either happening or on the horizon. There's an op-ed in today's LA Times that points to another financial issue. Anita Chabria writes of bills in the California legislature and the U.S. Congress that would compel internet companies like Google and Meta/Facebook to pay news services for the content they publish. Both Australia and Canada have passed laws that require internet platforms to negotiate payments with news publishers for the news they reprint. And Harris Mateen of the University of Houston estimates the internet platforms would owe U.S. publishers between $12 and $14 billion a year if Congress were to pass the Journalism Preservation Act. Now, just to point out, Facebook's revenue most recently was $135 billion, and Alphabet, the parent company of Google, was $307 billion. So that $12 to $14 billion wouldn't hurt them at all, and it might make all the difference in the world in newsrooms. Any thoughts about that?
Yeah, I would say, listen, we are at a point now where the newspaper industry, and when I say newspaper, I don't mean the way we, you and I would have read it as a kid. I mean digital. But we are at a point now where things are so low because of, you know, ownership, because of trust, because of audiences, you know, turning to all sorts of other sources, that I think this, we're going to need a multi-pronged approach. So while I'm not an expert in the Journalism Preservation Act, I would certainly say that, you know, if Google and Facebook, which they have monetized news content, then they should be paying their share. And I think that, you know, there's not going to be a single solution to fix the crisis that we're in. And we have got to realize that it is a crisis, and it's not just a crisis for news. It is a democratic crisis.
That's right.
So absolutely, yes, I would say it's got to be multi-pronged. And if Facebook and Google are using news content, then they should be paying their share. And as you mentioned, I mean, these are companies that absolutely should be, they can throw a lifeline to some of these news organizations that are laying off reporters. There's no question.
Yeah. And one other thing, I mean, sometimes people will say, but my God, that's complex. How would they figure out how much to pay each, the Times, and how much to pay this chain, and how would... Their algorithms are so sophisticated. Jerron Lanier, when I interviewed him about some of this stuff, he said they can do that stuff. What sounds impossible to us, their algorithms have already figured out. It's just they're not doing it.
Absolutely. I think your listeners would be shocked. I have a good friend from my doctoral program who works in industry, who studies, you know, marketing and, you know, studies algorithms. She lives in Florida, but whenever we get together, I'm always shocked at the amount of data that private companies are tracking and using. I think that, you know, they know exactly how they could provide that information and provide that data. My guess is they probably don't want to open up their books, because that's going to show a lot of other information that, you know, it's probably, you know, damaging in a lot of other ways as well. But yes, I think it could be figured out very easily.
And I do think that's one I think the public can understand. So before I let you go, solutions or reasons for hope?
That there are reasons for hope. Listen, I mean, I've dedicated a career to journalism, and, you know, if we are going to live in a democratic society, I think that, you know, the founders realized it. And I think, you know, we have realized it with different severity or different inflection points, you know, over our very, you know, young, you know, relatively young nation compared to other, other countries. But I think we have to see the role of accurate information in our society. And I think that we have to understand the role that journalists play in that society. And I think that we are at a moment where I think, you know, the next couple of years, I think, are going to be painful. But I think that what rises from it could be a better system, because I also want to say that, you know, I lament a very specific loss of journalism. I have to also say that, you know, the journalism, newspaper journalism that, you know, I worked in, even, you know, as a student in the 1990s and in the 2000s, wasn't really a system that was designed for everyone. It was a system that was designed to attract advertising dollars. So I think that this, you know, I want to be very clear that I don't, you know, I'm not saying I'm a cheerleader for the system that didn't exist for everyone. I think that we are looking at a new journalism, but it has to be a journalism that holds power to account. I think that we're at an inflection point, and I'm hopeful. And, you know, we are attracting students to journalism because they want to rebuild and reinvent what journalism is. And I think that that's very exciting. The nonprofit and the independent for-profit space is a growing sector. And that is something to become very excited about. But I think that we have got to help average citizens understand what is at stake. But we are also up against, you know, politicians that are also, you know, calling us an enemy of the people. We are also up against a very, very, very deep-pocketed misinformation ecosystem, you know, that's also, you know, very hard to counter. And, you know, I think this is going to be a crucial year, what happens in this November election.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think it's, you know, gosh, it's, it, you know, so Listen, I'm hopeful because, you know, I spend 100 hours a week working on this, and I have to believe in it, because it's just too important to let this idea go. I just can't believe that we're going to let this, you know, let the idea of a free press in our democratic society go. We just can't.
Okay, we're gonna leave it at that, Margot. And I'm with you, which is why we're talking right now, right?
Yeah.
So again, the book is Hedged, How Private Investment Funds Help Destroy American Newspapers and Undermine Democracy. For this conversation and many other interviews and articles, to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net. That's TerrenceMcnally, Terrence McNally, all one word, .net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com, to the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and links to probably 10 or 15 articles to flesh out the conversation, email me at T-E-McNally, T-E-M-C-N-A-L-L-Y, at mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, most major podcast sites. And you'll find years of podcasts at those sites and at my site. Michael Lewis, Naomi Klein, Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Connie Rice, Greg Boyle, George Packer. You can also follow me on Twitter at McNally Terrence. Thanks to Kiana Williams in production, George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices, and most of all to you, my listeners. Please share this podcast widely. And finally, thank you, Margaret Suska. Keep up your good work.
Thanks, Terrence. I appreciate it.